You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matthew Phelan, independent journalist, writing in Jacobin, Building the House of Breitbart. Also on the program today, the Trump transition team in disarray. Trump's name taken down from apartment buildings in New York City as humans complain. Meanwhile, two presidential electors call for more faithless electors. And is Trump really mulling a Muslim registry? Hillary Clinton's popular vote lead passes 1 million for what it's worth. I think it's worth something. Democrats announce a new, not so new, leadership slate in the Senate. And welcome to our government as a Trump money printing press. And lastly, the hilarious story of a man who tweeted an assassination attempt against Trump and wound up in jail.
Oh, boy. Got a little carried away there, Sam.
Oh, he certainly did. Let's go find out what the weather's going to be like today. Jimmy, you want to let us know about that?
Matt's got some great sound effects for us on the board, so we got that to look forward to, too.
Oh, God. It's going to be another one of those Wednesdays, ladies and gentlemen.
Hump day. Oh.
All that and more on today's Majority Report. Yeah, you know, I don't believe that people should, first of all, it's illegal to publicly threaten the president of the United States and to even aspire to assassinate the president of the United States. I'm not exactly what the specific charge is. But I mean, gosh, didn't the president-elect basically offer that up for his opponent in the presidential election? I guess she wasn't actually going to be, it wasn't the president-elect at that point.
The candidate, it's a completely different thing.
So a 24-year-old man from Ohio has been charged in a federal court after tweeting a threat to assassinate president-elect Donald Trump on election night. Now, on election night, was he president-elect at that point?
Depends what time.
Yeah. Zach Benson from Cleveland.
Zach.
Oh, my God. Now, here's the thing. He posted the remark on Twitter a few minutes before the Republican nominee was declared the winner of last week's election.
That's what I'm saying.
So, I mean, he tweeted, "My life goal is to assassinate Trump. I don't care."
That's very aspirational, the way he put it.
Yeah. "Don't care if I serve infinite sentences. That man deserves to decease existing." All right. Not so good with the grammar either. Seconds later, he tweeted, "Diplomacy effing fools. I hate you all. I want to bomb every one of your voting booths and your general areas." Sounds like he was... After the results were announced, many of those who opposed Trump rushed to Twitter to call for his assassination. But Benson is believed to be the first person to be charged in connection with one of those tweets. The Cleveland Plain Dealer reported that Benson told the Secret Service he spent the election night drinking and eating at a restaurant with his father and a friend. Well, apparently he deleted the tweets when he woke up in the morning, but the Secret Service had already been tipped off about them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. He's now been charged with making a threat to a successor to the presidency. It's interesting because he didn't make the threat to a successor. He made it to a candidate.
Made it to a candidate. That's right.
He's pending. He's thought to be in custody pending a bail hearing. Hmm. You know what I would think? One of those GoFundMe pages.
Yes.
Probably helpful for a guy like that who seems to have at least shown some remorse and, if not good sense, then the wrong grammar on something like that.
Yes.
Obviously.
Also not a presidential candidate himself, incidentally.
That guy. That's yes. Right. The point is, folks, you know, that's not something to aspire to. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Matthew Phelan. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Matthew Phelan. He is a freelance journalist writing in the Jacobin magazine, Building the House of Breitbart. Welcome to the program, Matthew.
Hello.
So, all right, let's go through this. This is obviously, it's a huge piece, and it's really important, obviously, because of the piece alerted me to reasons that it was important and explanatory to even like more strange things, like why was Farage from Britain at the last debate as a Trump surrogate?
Right.
But before we get there, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Obviously, Steve Bannon in the White House named the chief advisor to Donald Trump. It's important to know from whence he came. And it starts with the late Andrew Breitbart, a guy who I had the displeasure of being in many Twitter wars with and actually had the rather uncomfortable experience of meeting him in the flesh. And it was there was a lot of it. He was a very fleshy guy.
Yeah.
But all right, so let's go through this. Story is Building the House of Breitbart. And in many respects, at least in terms of how it influences the outcome of this election, the story starts, and of course it starts much earlier than this, but it starts with Peter Schweizer, who was one of the chief, who is Peter Schweizer? I mean, what role did he have at the Government Accountability Institute, and what is that of all things?
Okay, so at the Government Accountability Institute, he was officially the president. It was a small enough shop that he was really sort of just the main researcher. He was the lead investigator. And it was one in a long line of these nonprofit investigative journalism outfits that have been funded by rich Republican donors, you know, with the goal of filling the gap in the news media that has occurred with the sort of decimation of their profit margins and their ability to fund their own investigative journalism. So I would say beginning with the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity back around the Tea Party era in 2009 and 2010, these groups have like cropped up to do investigative journalism of a very slanted and incomplete sort to, you know, move the conversation in the news.
And, largely that is what the through line in all of this is that there is a, I don't want to say a gaming, but certainly an understanding of the media, of, you know, broadly speaking, of the corporate media and their, I don't know, susceptibility to this or how to characterize that. But I want to put a pin in the Mercer family because they're a pretty important one in this whole story. So, all right. So this Clinton cash, it's written by Schweitzer. It ends up being, you know, they get in this like this relationship with the New York Times, where the New York Times sort of like publishes it in like a serial manner. Is that what they did? And this was only about a year and a half ago, right?
They took an approach, I think, similar to how they partnered with WikiLeaks that one time. This kind of smug arm's length thing where they're like, we'll see what you got and we'll do some additional reporting ourselves. And would they produce a front page story about the Clinton Foundation's role and Secretary Clinton's role in helping this Russian nuclear agency buy a Canadian uranium mining company, Uranium One. And the issue with that story, much like a lot of things in Clinton Cash, is that they did the first part of a muckraking investigative report where they find things that look suspicious and then did not do the follow through of double checking and triple checking to make sure it was suspicious. So in a handful of these cases, in a handful of the allegations of Clinton Foundation pay to play influence peddling, they sort of fell apart upon closer scrutiny.
Which, of course, very few people did, including the FBI, which apparently at least was leaked to us in the weeks before the election, that the FBI had started an investigation based upon what was written explicitly in Clinton Cash.
The New York FBI offices, especially, from what I understand.
And I don't want folks to get the wrong impression here. I'm not saying that this is what led to the electoral outcome. Who knows what swayed those, 80,000 votes that were the difference in those three states over the course. But clearly there was an agenda here, right? There is an ongoing agenda here. So let's go back and remind people about Breitbart. And let's take the story from where and when he got that money. There was $10 million that came into Breitbart in 2011. And I remember this because I was giving him a lot of crap about it on Twitter as we were going back and forth, because they had to file and it wasn't clear where it came from. And at the time, what was really stunning about it is that Breitbart had been around for a while. And I think my once a week videos on YouTube was bringing in more cash.
What they reported to the SEC when they had to report these, I guess you would call them angel investments, whatever kind of capital infusion it technically was. They had to report their earnings for that year, and they reported it as somewhere between $1 and $1 million, which is either like a consequence of a tax dodge or just a consequence of the fact that they weren't really bothering with monetizing the business because they were getting so much free reporting from these outside nonprofits, these like Koch-funded nonprofits like the Franklin Center or the Robert Mercer-funded nonprofits like the Government Accountability Institute. And had a steady stream of cash from these sorts of outside investors who are essentially like Republican donors.
Right. I mean, that's basically what was going on. This was not a viable business. I mean, you're 3 years into the Obama administration, you're a right wing site, and you can't even drive any type of meaningful traffic or raise any funds at that time. It's just not a sustainable business. But it has value, and, I wish there was more of this on the left, frankly, to ideologues to pour money into it. So take us through Breitbart and Bannon.
Well, I guess I'll start with, like, their relationship individually. Hmm. When they met, Bannon had been a former Navy man, a former Goldman Sachs investment banker, and had started a sort of private practice doing investment banking around Hollywood. He had made a lot of money by selling Castle Rock to Ted Turner and getting paid in the form of sitcom royalties that included Seinfeld. And during that period, Bannon started using that money to make conservative documentaries. He started following Sarah Palin around to make something called The Undefeated. And that was a period when Andrew Breitbart and Bannon sort of entered each other's orbits at screenings for these kinds of documentary films. And he was a natural to start working with the site because he was Hollywood-based. He was independently financed. He could produce media for the organization and had similar Hollywood connections. Like Andrew Breitbart was more or less born and raised in Brentwood and hung out with a lot of the journalists who did not cover the entertainment industry. And they were a small sort of diaspora in Hollywood. So regardless of partisan lines, they were chummy. And it was those connections that kind of helped Andrew Breitbart along in the early phase of Breitbart News.
And tell me, like, I mean, I definitely was conscious of this with Breitbart, and I'm curious if Bannon sort of shared this. Breitbart, as far as I could tell, had no ideology other than, I mean, the guy didn't know anything about policy and bragged about it, that he didn't care really what the policy was. It was really just a resentment of Hollywood liberals, and then just sort of out of that grew his resentment of the left, broadly speaking. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
And was Bannon, would you say Bannon was sort of, they shared that notion?
I think Bannon might have more of a genuine ideology compared to Breitbart. I think that Bannon is probably more dangerous because he's more intellectually engaged. Breitbart, in some ways, is like more like Gavin McGinnis, the former mm-hmm. Vice magazine founder, who's kind of gone off into Archie Bunker land. They're cranky and they're unhappy with the direction of the country from sort of a very personal, barely articulated, just this place doesn't cater to me the way it ought to be.
Well, so walk us into what happens with Acorn.
Well, Acorn had existed for decades and was something that a lot of various conservative groups had been targeting. You know, like they'd been fighting for minimum wage stuff. So, you know, the Association of Restaurant Owners would be going after them. And in the run-up to the 2008 election and in the years preceding it or following it, I mean, conservatives were in a fever pitch about Acorn's Get Out the Vote efforts because they recognized that it was benefiting the Democrats by registering people in their core demographics, you know, urban minorities, working poor in various places in America. And it was just it was the white noise of the conservative echo chamber at the time that James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles, the two hidden camera performance artists who produced the videos, decided that they would do it and shopped it around and eventually got it in front of Andrew Breitbart. And ultimately, none of them really knew much about Acorn. They hadn't done the reading so much as they'd been the kind of people who had Fox News on in the background or were listening to Rush Limbaugh and had just knew that there was something fishy going on with Acorn, but were not cognizant of the details. And Breitbart brags about it in his memoir, Righteous Indignation. O'Keefe sort of brags about it in his own memoir, Breakthrough. And Hannah Giles told Sean Hannity essentially the same thing, that, you know, we didn't know much about it before we started.
But they managed to get it defunded and basically destroyed.
Yeah, which is genuinely horrifying. And I think probably had an impact on this election in a difficult to quantify way, much like many of the other voter suppression tactics. O'Keefe pushed some of the voter ID law stuff by doing some stunts back in 2012, for example.
And I just want to stay with that Acorn thing. O'Keefe ends up paying $100,000 and Giles ends up paying $50,000 in settlements in defamation suits brought to, against them. Who covers that? Like, who starts paying for O'Keefe? I mean, did O'Keefe pay that out of his pocket?
Absolutely not. I mean, that money came from, well, there's a couple facets to this. On the one hand, during that period, direct mail, like a founder of direct mail called, Richard Art Vigeri, who started out in the Reagan years. He had entered a deal with O'Keefe's nonprofit Project Veritas to do the fundraising. So, they're collecting a lot of, you know, sad and delusional, mom and pop donors that are sort of filling out some of the, budget needs for Project Veritas, but they're also getting like major money from more traditional, wealthy, conservative, and libertarian donors. And Project Veritas started out really with seed money provided by a man named Eric O'Keefe, who worked for the 1980 libertarian campaign that David Koch was the vice president on. And he kind of migrated with them away from the Libertarian Party in the 80s to just become like a go-between functionary in the various, you know, nonprofit citizens groups and astroturfing projects that they set up over the years. And he had been brought on by James and Hannah's lawyer, Mike Madigan, to be sort of the executor of his emergency legal trust. And so it's hard to say how much of that money that came into Project Veritas in the early years is directly from the Kochs, but it's essentially from the network of libertarian donors that they have at their, you know, Aspen meetings and all the rest of it.
Interesting. Okay, so move on from there. This, in many ways, you know, it raises the profile of Breitbart. Still does not become particularly profitable per se, but they're getting money and. This guy, Eric O'Keefe, tell us a little bit more about him, because he was, like you say, he came from the Koch world, and he ended up basically setting up Veritas, I don't know, 2.0.
Yeah. He essentially, at the time, was helping to run an organization that the Kochs had up in Chicago called the Sam Adams Institute and the Sam Adams Alliance, excuse me. And the goal with the Sam Adams Alliance was to fund and provide logistical support and run like training for aspiring citizen journalists, people who would run things like the Texas Bulldog or the Broward Bulldog or like some of these, like conservative blogs. Like they wanted to encourage and expand the conservative internet echo chamber. And so it was a natural thing for him to see the success of the Acorn videos in the media and want to come to O'Keefe's defense during the early phase of lawsuits against James and Hannah as a result of the videos. And what he wound up doing over the early part of 2010 was he and a fellow board member of the Sam Adams Alliance named Dennis Calabresi encouraged a former Sam Adams employee named Izzy Santa to sign on as James's executive director to help run the parts of Project Veritas that a smart, competent human being would have to be there to do. File the paperwork with the state and take care of the accounting and the books. And Eric O'Keefe paid for all this. I don't know. I couldn't tell you if he paid for it out of his pocket or if he was sort of a go-between. But that was the origin of the organization, was as just another Kochtopus tentacle in the larger subset of citizen journalist tentacles that they were working on.
And what's fascinating, you write here, is that O'Keefe basically began to challenge Breitbart himself as, you know, almost like a, I don't know, you know, being a godfather of more little spawn. Like, I mean, each one wanted to explain that dynamic. I found that fascinating.
Okay. Well, I think O'Keefe recognized pretty early that, you know, this is not a trick you can do multiple times unless you are a master thespian going undercover in disguise and pulling these stunts. And that if he was going to endure in this field, he would need to be the person who selects up and coming college Republican weirdos and employs their volunteer savvy and their youthful enthusiasm to produce more hidden camera hatchet jobs. And Breitbart, immediately after the success of Acorn, thought of himself personally in that same way. And he told Politico that he wanted to be an American idol for these, like, weaponized conservative freedom fighters or that sort of thing. And he didn't get a chance to, because that is what O'Keefe wanted to do, and he got cut out. And supposedly there was a lot of bad blood between them over this period. Someone who used to work at Project Veritas told me that like O'Keefe would say things like, Breitbart wants me to be his puppet, and he doesn't want to be, he wanted to, you know, create his own business with Project Veritas from very early on.
All right. So Breitbart dies. I guess that's a good point. I mean, the man anyways, passes away, or at least, that's what we've been led to believe. But Breitbart is no longer with us as a personality, but his legacy lives on. So Bannon takes over, and what happens? Does money come in at that point? They decide to expand to Great Britain, which I find sort of what was behind that decision? And this is something I didn't realize, how much of a role they may have played in Brexit. But give us the backdrop of Breitbart expanding into England.
I think a lot of that money was still leftovers from the initial donation. But you get a hint of how and why they were able to make this expansion by who they partnered with over there. And they hired a former employee of something, this neoconservative think tank based in the UK called the Henry Jackson Society. And for Breitbart London's first editor-in-chief, they hired a kid named Raheem Kassam, who used to work at the Henry Jackson Society. And the Henry Jackson Society had a bunch of people from Bush's Iraq War Brain Trust, like former Assistant Secretary of Defense Richard Perle and former Defense Department employee Bruce Jackson, and people like Bill Kristol and Clifford May from the Project for a New American Century behind it. And I would have to assume that all of these people saw a benefit in stoking sort of Islamophobic immigration fears and refugee fears for their own sort of future redirection towards neocon regime change projects and other things abroad. And from a staffing standpoint, that was critical to Breitbart's expansion into London.
Had Bannon already moved Breitbart towards, I mean, like, you know, Breitbart was, I think, a different ilk of racist than Bannon was. I sort of feel like Breitbart was just. Am I right in that assessment? And if so, in what way? I mean, it seems like Bannon was just like a lot more leaning into it in some way. Like Breitbart would pretend. I remember when he hired Stranahan and to go and ostensibly. It seemed to me it was just more of like, you know, well, we're not racists and we're going to prove it by being sort of coincidentally racist. Whereas Bannon's just like full on, I don't care if you call us racist. Everybody should be racist. We need to be segregated in some way. I mean, do I have that sense of them correct in your estimation?
There's a complexity to it, because I think even Bannon, if you press him on it, is going to deny being racist, although then he will say things about, you know, protecting like culture and cultural purity in a way that sort of suggests that whether or not he realizes it, it's pretty racist. With Breitbart, your sense, I think, is completely correct. I mean, he compared himself and the movement he was building to the civil rights movement on cable talk shows, kind of delusionally. His whole goal with the Shirley Sherrod video was to expose the quote-unquote real racists in the Department of Agriculture bureaucracy, who were African Americans prejudiced against white farmers somehow, and had taken the quotes completely out of context, and they proved the opposite. But his goal was sort of to redefine what racism was, and that like this new form of political correctness and affirmative action and all of these things were forms of racism that he thought was more pernicious. Whereas Bannon is uniformly concerned with Islamic radicalism as if we are going to enter a 21st century equivalent of the Crusades. He sees Syrian refugees and immigration issues stemming from the crisis in Syria as like Saracen hordes coming in through, maybe they'll take over Spain, maybe they'll take over Turkey and then Germany and other things. Like it's very medieval in its outlook, and speaks to a long history he has of obsessing over old military history books and strategy, according to some former people who worked with him as a investment banker. Someone who was a Universal Studios president mentioned something about that to the Los Angeles Times.
And so, and we should say, once they moved over to Great Britain, they shared, I guess, a guy who was appointed the editor-in-chief there, right? This guy, Kassam, he ends up being a senior advisor to Nigel Farage.
Right. And then when Farage fails to get a seat in Parliament during his 2015 campaign, Kassam slides right back in as editor-in-chief of Breitbart London. It's really weird. I mean, I can't think of anything like that that's happened on the left in America or Britain in my recollection. You know, after Occupy, the editor-in-chief of Adbusters did not suddenly join the Sanders campaign or the Clinton campaign as a chief strategist. It's weird, and it's not journalism per se. It's this strange blending of what opposition research is and what.
I mean, I'm not as concerned with. I mean, yeah. The thing is that Breitbart is, you know, there was an animal, you know, like a media animal, you know, blogs. We don't see them as much in the same way, where it's sort of like advocacy slash information news that is, you know, that is at least I don't want to say biased, but is has a political slant. Breitbart is just sort of a. Is like that, but more of a sewer in some respects. It seems to me, what it exemplifies is if a guy can go from running Breitbart to being a senior advisor to Nigel Farage and then back to Breitbart again, it gives you a sense of. I think we all know what Nigel Farage is out like, but it gives you a sense of what Breitbart's agenda is at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question of judging him based on his actions and not necessarily what he says. And I'm speaking specifically about Bannon, because you have people like Ben Shapiro and others who left Breitbart in disgust with how he ran it. Trying to think of who actually, you know, somebody, a former like press secretary kind of person, a spokesman for Breitbart, said that he that Bannon ran those editorial meetings like a white supremacist rally, and that there was a real push to find any news story or even like the shred or a whiff of a news story that linked immigrants to crime or terrorism or anything else that would make Breitbart's readers afraid and angry about immigration. So the general set of tactics suggests a lot of racial resentment and race theory and race animosity, but Bannon repeatedly will deny it in interviews and sort of play it down, and it's only Bannon truly knows how racist he is.
Right, but we do know how much they're leveraging it, right? And
so, yeah, and that's huge. The answer is a lot. Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about Robert Mercer again, because this is a name that people should familiarize themselves with. Mercer gives some money to funds Breitbart, particularly on the eve of Trump's campaign. Mercer, at the very least, this is off the top of my head, I know he funded FASO up in the 19th district of New York against Zephyr Teachout to the tune of millions of dollars, I think he was able to bring in. Maybe half a million of his own money, and then he brought other funders in there. And we can't really know for sure, because there's a lot of dark money involved in this. But we know that he was willing to at least put his name on half a million or so. And he is largely responsible. He and his daughter are largely responsible, at least with getting credit, for bringing Bannon into Trump's orbit, or I should say directly into his campaign. Because one thing that you talk about that I think people had, you know, speculated is that there was a pay for play relationship between the Trump campaign and Breitbart news outlet.
Right. It was something that BuzzFeed had reported, and they had about four anonymous inside sources at Breitbart News who told them that Trump and, by extension, the Trump campaign had paid Breitbart for the glowing coverage they received. And I don't know to what extent that specific operation overlapped with the fact that Robert Mercer invested heavily in Breitbart News. The main clues that we have that Robert Mercer did invest in Breitbart News is that Breitbart had to disclose a debt to a limited liability company with the same address as Robert Mercer's hedge fund, Renaissance Technologies. And the company that they owed it to was something called Gravitas Maximus LLC. And, you know, it seems like it was a cutout, because it has the same address. And it's not just, I'd like to emphasize, Bannon, who was someone that Robert Mercer and his daughter, Rebecca, recommended to Trump. It was also Kellyanne Conway, who worked for a PAC that was funded largely by Mercer money. And this guy, Bossy, who was like the president of Citizens United, who ultimately joined as deputy campaign manager for Donald Trump, having previously been the president of the Citizens United Foundation, which was also funded by Mercer, about $3.6 million between 2012 and 2014. So swamp creatures.
I mean, this is pretty stunning, because we're talking about, you know, a universe now. And even though the Koch brothers and that Eric O'Keefe guy ends up being a never Trumper, right?
Right.
They basically launched this thing. They launched this thing that ended up delivering Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's a real splintering of the Republican base. And it's a sort of cleaves away from the sort of free market fundamentalist libertarian wing to a wing that is nativist, partially in a economic sense of these people who feel like they have been passed over by the global economy in a very justified way, and people who feel like they're being passed over by like global culture and internet culture and like pluralism in a way. And it's Van Jones has described this frequently as marbled, like the economic and the racial issues that have been stoked have been sort of like hopelessly convoluted and mixed in with one another. And that component of it, and especially wealthy Islamophobes afraid of like a caliphate being produced by ISIS, have become the both the monetary and the grassroots engine of the GOP under Trump.
And we should say, Frank Gaffney now reported to be on the transition team. And Frank Gaffney is just a lunatic anti-Muslim. Mercer was also the guy who funded a lot of Pam Geller's stuff on the supposed Ground Zero mosque.
Right. And he paid for like $1 million campaign ad that someone in New York used to like run for a local office on the back of opposing the Ground Zero mosque. And it's hard to know what really motivates Robert Mercer. He's a software engineer who sort of slid from working for IBM into quant style algorithm heavy hedge fund market playing, and he doesn't like to talk much. A former boss called him like an automaton when he worked at IBM. Mm. And he strikes me as one of those people who, because he's technically proficient in some of these maths and sciences, feels like he probably gets everything else too. And so whatever like historical or journalistic material he has absorbed has confirmed for him that, we face a grave danger from this like motley group of extremists in Baghdad and Syria and elsewhere.
One note I just want to drop in here, and maybe not necessarily apropos of anything, but when we talk about Breitbart, between Breitbart and Fox News, in terms of total mm-hmm. reader interactions with articles on Facebook in the last month, between October 10th and November 10th, Fox News and Breitbart combined outpaced CNN, BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal together. By far.
It's mortifying.
By far. 45 million interactions for Fox News, 18 for CNN, 18 for Breitbart, BuzzFeed, 17 million, Huffington Post, 14 million. New York Times, 7 million. Washington Post, 3 million. Wall Street Journal, 975,000. So, things like talking about Breitbart, obviously, rather important. And I have a feeling there's, a version of you, Matthew, in England who's either hopefully produced a story like this or is contemplating one in terms of anticipating like what Breitbart's role was in Brexit. I don't know how well it does there, but certainly, there's a strong attachment to Nigel Farage. All right. So lastly, let's just wrap this up here because it is. We are now left with this sort of the Breitbartization of our government. And we now have people referring to it. I think that guy you were talking about, I can't remember his name now. I want to say something, Barrara or something like that. The former PR guy, he basically said Breitbart has now become more or less like, the government media source at this point.
Yeah. There's a lot terrifyingly up in the air right now with the Trump transition team thing. And, clearly Bannon has a kind of grand vizier Rasputin kind of role now alongside Trump. And it sort of remains to be seen, I feel like, how these people who are not expecting to win are going to fill all of the positions they have to fill. And I'm kind of suspecting that the neoconservative wing of the GOP are just going to like find a way to fill those slots, and that
I mean, this seems to be Bannon's agenda. I mean, he seems to be the only one. I mean, I guess maybe Reince has an agenda to fill it with sort of, I guess, more, I don't know, establishment, libertarian economic style. I'm thinking of Paul Ryan, Republicans.
Yeah.
Mike Pence seems to would have the agenda, it seems to me, to fill these positions with Christian Reconstructionists. And Bannon is certainly pushing for these neocons. And I don't know that there's really how much of a conflict there is between all those. It seems to me they could all get along in a room. There's some infighting, but I imagine that has to do more with power than it does with any type of like ideological disposition.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're going to, a lot of the people who voted for Trump are going to find out how kind of weak their commitments were to, you know, holding Wall Street to task or these like global financial elites. Like their plans, even from what Trump was saying in the debates, suggest that they're going to be very business friendly to the point of kind of ignoring some of the populist promises that they made. And that's something that, at least from the conversations Bannon has conducted publicly, he sounds like he really believes in some of that populist stuff and that he really wants to correct that aspect of thinking inside the Beltway. But one, I don't see it happening with the allies he's made. And two, I kind of am not particularly convinced that privately he really has it as a priority.
Good point. Matthew Phelan, the piece is Building the House of Breitbart. Apparently it's still being constructed, and now they just call it the White House. written in Jacobin magazine. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure being on. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I get the feeling. It's going to be interesting to see how many of those Trump voters are actually like, hey, what happened to the populism? I would imagine there's some of that there, but even our friend from Pennsylvania who called in yesterday, and folks, if you didn't hear the call that we had yesterday, we're going to put that that YouTube on our front page of majority.fm. This is something you want to see. We got a call yesterday, and he had been going back and forth with me on Twitter. He's a political consultant who was working on in Pennsylvania, working on the Democratic campaign there, and formerly run, I think, for Pennsylvania House. And he told us on the program yesterday that during the course of the Get Out the Vote, there was, you know, when you're supposed to be talking to nearly 100% sure Democratic voters, or I should say sure Democrat voters if they vote, that they were getting all sorts of reports that their Get Out the Vote list had like 20% Trump voters on it, which is a huge disaster because you are literally motivating other voters to go to the polls, and you're expending your own resources to do that, and you're not reaching the voters that you need to reach. And Becky Bond and Zach Exley, two senior advisors with Bernie Sanders' campaign, had written a piece to that effect in Huffington Post. And I spoke to them yesterday. We're going to run that interview over the next couple of days. But his argument, political consultant from PA who was out there on the ground, was that he believes there were new voters, that the Trump voters were new people. They were low propensity voters, which would have mean that they had not voted basically in 2012. He also thinks that to a large extent they were driven by racism, which is not to say that they're not suffering economic deprivation. And I think there's certainly an argument that with at least a percentage of racists, their racism becomes more acute as they are suffering because they want someone to blame.
Do you remember the story we covered in 2012 of the woman in West Virginia with some kind of funny newspaper write-up? And she said in the article, she's like, look, Obama's a Muslim. He probably wasn't even born here. I don't care what they say, blah, blah, blah. But the hook of the article was that she was voting for him because she said better to be something to the effect of like better to be a Muslim than have a silver spoon in your mouth.
Right. Right. I mean, I think it's quite clear that Mitt Romney was not able to capitalize in the way that Trump was. Now, part of the reason why Mitt Romney wasn't able to do that is because Barack Obama ran against him as one of those guys.
Vigorously.
And that was also set up in the primary by Newt Gingrich. So the point of all this is that the myriad of narratives that were being fed can all be true on some level. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. In my mind, so much of this, and I keep saying it over and over again, boils down to the campaign that Clinton ran. Now, it's also, I think there's also an argument to be made that a candidate like Clinton couldn't run any other type of campaign because they just couldn't conceive of it. You know, someone, and I guess I'm pivoting here to the fight for DNC chair. We're going to go over some of the DNC leadership. Bernie Sanders did not get the one that we had speculated yesterday that was out there, but he did get a position in the Democratic leadership that apparently is pretty significant from people I have talked to. He was named chair of outreach. And the point is that there's money there. I mean, there are resources. But the reason why you want someone like Keith Ellison is not simply because of the message that he delivers. It's that the ideas that he has are necessarily more about grassroots organizing than I think someone who comes from a less populist political perspective can contemplate. Which is not to say that it's impossible, you know, I suppose, Bernie Sanders could have run Hillary Clinton's campaign, or Bernie Sanders' people could have run Hillary Clinton's campaign, but, I mean, like, literally they could have. But in reality, they never would. And they never, the Clinton people would never hire them, and these people probably wouldn't work for them. Or maybe they would, but the Clinton people would never have them. And that is a function of sort of like the second level of the implications of a certain ideology. But there's no doubt in my mind that had Hillary Clinton run a general campaign that was more oriented towards the economy, towards jobs. I mean, look at her closing message. Closing message said none of those things.
Beyonce.
It was all the proactive version of saying that Donald Trump is a moral monster. It was just saying, like, we can be not moral monsters, which is just a way to activate the fact. But nothing about him being an elite and out of touch. Nothing about providing jobs. Now, of course, maybe they felt on their campaign, and rightly so. Maybe they was, well, we can't really go with the elite and out of touch thing,
right?
Because,
or for what it's worth, how about they're all moral monsters because of the Ryan budget? I mean, you could even just deepen
that
message.
Well, that was my whole
thing. That was your whole thing. But I'm saying there's no contradiction between using that language.
The point isn't that there was not opportunities for them. They did not want to choose them for whatever reason.
Right.
And that is why, that is the connection between the ideology and the execution of what needs to happen in terms of the Democratic Party from an organizing and sort of practical, mechanical perspective. I got a little bit off topic, but it's important to see this about, I guess it's the Breitbart and Bannon who has led us to this. And, I mean, look, this is a little bit self-serving, but it's the truth here. We don't have on the left the Robert Mercers, the Koch brothers, on and on and on, the Eric O'Keefes. We simply don't have that. People talk about George Soros. I've been doing this for 12 years. I don't think I've ever handled in my hand a dollar from George Soros. Not directly. I'm trying to even contemplate if I've ever, indirectly. They never gave to Air America. Now, I don't know if I blame them necessarily. The Democracy Alliance came in there and they were like, this is, but I also think that the way that they do stuff has not been successful at this point. I mean, you see the way that the right does this, right? They just throw money at stuff. For every O'Keefe and Breitbart that's out there, there's maybe a couple others who didn't go anywhere. But they throw money at this stuff. We don't have that. And to a large extent, it's probably for the best. I don't know that I would get along with them. I don't know they get along with me. Now, I would be really surprised if we don't see a lot of money that comes into not necessarily this space, but broadly speaking, left media, because that seems to be like the only thing that's left. But I guess the self-serving part is like, you know, this is, we're a tiny flea, but sometimes we can make, you know, somebody itch somewhere, right? Is that really what I want to compare ourselves
to? Yeah, that's a little demoralizing.
Well, we're like a gang of fleas.
Okay, sure. We're like a rough and tumble gang of fleas.
Make them itch that's a good tagline. Majority Report, make them itch.
Right.
Yeah.
We can...
Yeah, that sounds like some type of
disease.
I don't know if it's a weird disease.
Causing
pretty...
mild discomfort. How's that? Yeah. The Majority Report causing mild discomfort. We'll give you a rash.
Giving American fascism a rash. Yeah. Great. We'll really be hits in the gulags. Walking around being like, Tiffany's a six. Oh, re-education time. All right, cool. I'll be right down there.
Are you guys going to the live Majority Report in the mess hall tonight?
Yeah. Yeah. Michael's going to do right-wing Mandel in the cantina, guys.
That's right.
Sneak off before the labor period.
Apparently, the tickets to the show cost one slice of bread that you have to. Oh, God. I also want to put this in the fun half of the program. I mean the non-fun half. there are emails going around now. You know, people signing petitions for electors, and maybe we'll try and find some, put some on the blog. I mean, you know, let me just start with this. Well, let me do the elector story. Why not? Do you recall that we were talking about two presidential electors, or at the very least one, which we had quoted, who were already announcing prior to the election that they were not going to, they were going to be faithless. They were Democratic electors. They were already saying that we will refuse to vote for Hillary Clinton as an elector. And so we were talking, like, she's going to need 271, 272. Didn't work out. Well, those same two Democratic members of the Electoral College have launched a campaign to get their fellow Republican electors to vote against Donald Trump or to vote for somebody else. They have dubbed moral electors, which is an attempt to persuade 37 of their Republican colleagues to bail on Trump, just enough to block his election and leave the final decision to the House of Representatives. They have the support of a third elector, Washington State's Washington State one. I'm not clear if that's a Democratic or a Republican one. They intend to encourage Republican electors not to vote for Clinton, but to write in Mitt Romney or John Kasich. If enough agree, they would be sent to the House of Representatives, which would choose from among the top three vote-getters. 37 assumes that Michigan will be in Trump's column. Michigan has not announced their final results yet. It appears that he's won, but it's not definitive. So assume that it's 37. Very hard to believe they're going to get 37 electors to do this. They don't all need to come from one state or two states or whatnot, but there's no reason not to push it, in my estimation. People have written to me on Twitter like, this would create an incredible amount of violence. Well, I guess what? I think his election will too.
Has.
But I think it's going to get, I think we're at the beginning of some really nasty crap. And an attempt like this, even a failed one, furthers the narrative that Trump is a weak president, that he does not have the support of the American public, no matter how you quantify it. I mean, certainly we know that Hillary Clinton will receive at least 1 million more votes than him in this election, at least 1 million more popular votes. So we know where the majority of the American people are. Trust me on this. This is the Majority Report. And I'm not talking that he failed to get a plurality. In other words, it's not just that more people voted against him than voted for him. It's that more people voted specifically for a different person than him. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, particularly when, you know, you're putting your kids to bed at night and you want to convince them that, yeah, the majority of the country, and more than the majority of the country, disagrees with this guy and his policies. And so if you get one of those emails or you go, I would Google and we'll try and find it, moral electors, get people to support it. Can't hurt. It cannot hurt. You know, at this point, we're grasping for straws.
But it is important, though. I agree. I mean, there's a secondary value to it. This is part of denormalizing, delegitimizing, yep. always being on the offensive. There's no time to give him a chance or any of this nonsense. It needs to be aggressive from the beginning.
I will also say, yesterday I spoke about the idea of Barack Obama making a recess appointment to the Supreme Court. And it's there. That an opportunity to do that exists, apparently, is even more limited than I had discussed yesterday. They can keep the Senate in a pro forma session, it seems like, constantly, even regardless whether or not it's a new session or not. And depending on how you interpret the Supreme Court, it could be 3 to 10 days would be the days that you need for a recess. Now, with all that said, all of that, what I've just said about 3 to 10 days, this coming from that National Labor Relations Board versus Canning, I think it was, in 2014, that the narrow question the Supreme Court was faced with was much more narrow than their decision that the court read. Now, I think it was a majority decision about this recess thing. In other words, it's not inconceivable that the Office of Legal Counsel could come up with an opinion saying that's dicta. In other words, all the extra stuff that they wrote in that decision was extra stuff and does not have the same force of law as the narrow result of that one case. So theoretically, what could happen is the Office of Legal Counsel could say to President Obama, yes, you have a right to put in a recess appointment, presumably when this session ends and the next one begins. And he could send his nominee. I would recommend that it wouldn't be Merrick Garland. I would make one that was far more politically controversial or had more political salience, perhaps a woman or man of color. And then force a plaintiff to sue the government. Someone has to have standing here to sue the government to say that my decision that I received at the Supreme Court was invalid because of the sitting of this person. This whole process could take months. It would be highly controversial. But again, good thing to push for. No reason not to. Will Barack Obama do it? I would bet nearly everything I own that he won't. If I were in a betting mood after having got the election so wrong. Well, I'm not.
But not good. Sad.
But I would bet that he would go against it. But nevertheless, we must stay on offense. And, you know, like around these parts here, we're trying to figure out exactly how to go about doing that. But we are going to be on the offense. You know,
we don't get schlonged.
We don't get schlonged?
No,
I don't know what that means.
You don't remember that? What? That was another Trump highlight.
Well, nevertheless, we don't get schlonged. And we're going to be on the offense here. So we're going to be doing all sorts of stuff that and, you know, working out that are going to basically be a series of Hail Marys over and over and over again.
And we're also not going to retreat into a fantasy universe. We're like, yeah, just kick back, wait for it, watch the greens come to power. We're going to try to do some serious work.
Oh, yeah. One of the other things I'm going to do is, like, it's going to be my agenda to call out idiots, not just on the right, but also on the left, and their stupidity. I had someone tweet at me like, Jimmy Dore was right about the election. What? That the issue isn't whether or not Trump could win. The issue is that it would be good for progressives. Now, I guess if tomorrow lightning strikes and it also it strikes the White House, let's say, because it's coming from a thunderbolt of a particularly left-leaning unicorn that's floating through the air and has the ability to send thunderbolts down. And when the electromagnetic power of the thunderbolt hits the White House, what it does is it turns back time a little bit, but maintains part of what we know of the future. I mean, this is still diagramming this out. I may need a chalkboard for this. But
chalkboards are coming.
Chalkboards are coming. We're getting a lot of chalkboards.
We're a little bit more metro, so maybe a whiteboard.
It'll probably be a whiteboard.
I want a whiteboard. I want to break my cuticles.
But yes, maybe Keith Ellison, although apparently to a guy like Jimmy Dore, Keith Ellison's no good because he was endorsed after Bernie and Elizabeth Warren by Chuck Schumer.
My beautiful black brother and his noble Islamic faith will lead us.
I don't know. Maybe Jimmy wants, I don't know. Who is it that Jimmy wants to be DNC chair? Susan
Same
Sarandon?
Progressive.
Nevertheless, of course, progressives are going to be somewhat more ascendant here, which is not to say that they wouldn't, that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren wouldn't be ascendant had Clinton won. Bernie Sanders would have been chair of the banking committee. And now
yeah,
guess what
but
he's
that's
not.
How we lose.
Guess what he's
because
not.
Because we would
now.
Have been lulled into sleep.
That's right.
And then there might have actually been relief for college student loans. We might not have invaded Iran. We might have done the bare minimum to save the planet. And then you know what
Whatever.
Happens?
Whatever.
The Green
Listen,
Party
I don't
want
to relitigate
over.
This. The point is that in addition to causing mild chafing on the body of the fascist Borg that has taken over this country, I'm going to attempt to, get people to listen to stupidity. Some of his phone call things are funny. He should just stick to that instead of trying to, strategize what's going to happen in the future when you don't even realize, what the status is of the filibuster or how, a bill becomes law. All right. But I'm getting off topic. Folks, tomorrow, I think we're probably going to take a tech day. Because we're still a mess. Even from post-election, we had, turned the office upside down and somehow in the drunken stupor that followed for the next 8 days, we have not been able to repair it. So we very well may be taking a tech day tomorrow. Check the blog. We'll tweet that out if we do that. But right now we're going to head into the fun half of the program where we're going to take your calls. Oh, don't forget, this program relies on your membership. We do our best to inform you and have some depth to what we cover and have some fun. The corporate media, I can assure you, is going to get much worse. As bad as you think it's been under a President Trump, I assure you, we see it every day now, the normalization of this guy. And I would be surprised if that didn't include a place like MSNBC. Who knows? Maybe they decide like, hey, this is a good business move to be in opposition, but don't hold your breath. And so liberal talk radio is not what it was. All due respect. I mean, short of Tom Hartman, I don't even know that it exists in any meaningful way. Some good programs on Sirius, but I'm talking about reaching everywhere for free. Those type of medias, we don't have that anymore. We had it for a very brief moment. So this is what you got, sorry, for the time being.
Sorry, not sorry.
But so if you can support this program, I hope you find it worth your while. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, you're going to need plenty of coffee during this time. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's a co-op. Support it. Also, you can skim some money off the profits of Jeff Bezos. And maybe the dead Sam Walton, if that deal goes through, what's going to stop anything now? So if you buy stuff from Jet.com, Amazon.com, at the very least, do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. We get a little kickback. You will notice no difference. Quick break, fun half, sure. Tech day tomorrow, everything else, bye.